pleased to have as my guest today, Lee Martin. We'll be discussing Lee's new book, The Bright Forever, published by Shea Earhart Books. It's now available in your bookstores. And first of all, Lee, did I pronounce the publisher correctly?
That's right, Shea Earhart.
Good. Lee, the Bright Forever is a bit of a change for you. If we take a look at your publishing credits, you have a book of stories, The Least You Need to Know, two memoirs, From Our House and Turning Bones, and a novel, Quaker Town, which was published in 2001. And when you approached The Bright Forever, it's, like I say, it's a bit of a departure for you, and one that I think is a good departure. What was your thinking when you started The Bright Forever?
Well, Casey, I had this story that I needed to tell, and it was a story that was complicated. Not only complicated in the sense of how to approach it, but complicated in the sense of morality. And so I wanted to try to tell this story in a way that would make it suspenseful, but also in a way that would invite the reader into a consideration of the moral responsibility of the characters to one another. So, you know, I keep thinking back to that thing that Percy Lubbock said in The Art of Fiction, or The Craft of Fiction, which was, point of view is the only choice a writer need make. Mm-hmm. Everything else will fall into place. And so, with this book, The Bright Forever, I think the book really started to, the story really started to take shape for me when I hit upon the point of view choice of using a series of four narrators, four first-person narrators, and letting them appear throughout the book from time to time as sort of a Greek chorus, breaking up the third-person point of view sections of the book. So it was when I found those four narrators and I started to realize that this was a story about this community and that various people from the community who were directly or indirectly involved with the situation at hand were going to speak, that I really started to feel the story and to feel the inner lives of the people in this place.
Mm-hmm. And the structure is very, it's a very distinct structure, and I really liked it. And one of the voices is Raymond R., Raymond Royal Wright. And he starts off the novel by saying, "I'm not saying I didn't do it, I don't know." And you, I think, very effectively use some very short segments in the book to advance the story and to advance the characters. And the prose is very spare, as it is in all of your writing, and very beautiful. And but then there's also another character, Mr. Dees. Mr. Dees, I think, was my favorite character in the novel. It takes place in a small town in Indiana. And he warns us, readers, that this is a story as hard to hear as it is for me to tell. And that's true, isn't it, Lee? This is a story that is very difficult, and I wanted to rush to judgment with several of these characters, and I found myself having to back off a little bit as I found more about them. And how did you decide how much you were going to let us know about the Mr. Dees and Raymond R. and Katie Mackey and Claire as time went on?
I wanted each section of the book, particularly those first-person sections, and you're right, some of them are very short. For example, just one line, as you just quoted from the first section of the book, Raymond R.'s section. I wanted those sections to call into question what we had read previously and to also point forward to further plot developments and further character developments. Naturally, I think that it's really important for a writer never to sit in judgment of one's characters, to merely inhabit those characters and to see where they're going to take us. So with Dees, for example, and I think he's the most complicated character in the novel, but with Dees, it was a matter of letting him have expression of what he carried secretly inside him, and then complicating that thing, making it appear that he wasn't completely honorable but also making it clear that there was a reason for that. That here was a man who lived in this town, never married, no family. He happens to be a mathematics teacher who tutors young children in the summer. And he happens to be fascinated with one of his students, 9-year-old Katie Mackey. It's easy, I think, on the surface, to rush to judgment with Dees, to say that what he felt for Katie Mackey was completely inappropriate. But I hope as the book goes along and you keep hearing from Dees and you keep seeing him from other people's perspectives as well, that you start to think that really this is a man, as he says in his own words, who didn't quite know what to do with the love that he felt for this girl, which is, I think, on a certain level, a genuine affection that he has for her. It's just that the confusion of what he feels for her gets him into situations that are problematic, troubling, wrong, perhaps. But as I said, I want that character to be complicated to the point that we have what I would call an uneasy sympathy for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that in The Bright Forever that love is not a simple matter for any of the characters, that Junior and Patsy Mackey, their love is complicated, and the love between Claire and Raymond R. is complicated. And complicated might not be the right word, but it's not very smooth and easy and just something that happens. And you set it in a small town in Indiana. And the city, the town that it takes place in is a very important part of the novel, as it is in the memoir that you wrote. That's kind of your background. Tell us a little bit about why you set the novel in Indiana, in a small town in Indiana, and what you were hoping to do with the city, because it's a very effective part of the story.
Well, the novel takes place in 1972 at a time in that part of the country, in small towns, where crime had not really become commonplace and as heinous as it is these days. So, you know, the book focuses upon one of the first truly horrific crimes in the small town. And what I wanted to do with that was I wanted to see how that crime would test the loyalties of people in a small community at a time period when everything seemed to be idyllic. At one point in the book, Dees says that he often thinks that there was some false promise in that summer evening, in the way the water of the river caught the sunlight, and that people thought they were free from work and they were free from one another. And what I hope happens is that the book shows us that we're never free from one another. We're always connected. We're connected with people that we don't even know at a certain point in time. A stranger's action ripples out and causes effects that we can't predict or anticipate. And so in some sense, you know, it's the story of a small town trying to come to terms and grips with a tragic event. Early in the novel, Katie's brother, Gilly, says that he thought he knew what family was, but he didn't really until he saw his sister's bicycle left leaning against a parking meter uptown on the courthouse square. And of course, that's the moment when he knows that Katie's missing.
And he feels badly because he's kind of brought that on a bit by some comments that he's made.
Yeah, you know, I'm really interested in how characters create their situations. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not an intentional act that creates something. It can be something very, very simple. And I was interested in this book in the really small details that then have tremendous significance on down the road. So, for example, that evening when Katie has said, I'm going to take my library books back to the library now, her brother Gilly notices that she hasn't put her sandals on. And he thinks later, if he had only said, Katie, your sandals, there would have been a matter of seconds when she would have been putting on her sandals that would have altered the path that she was taking through time and space, while at the same moment other people were moving through time and space, and unfortunate intersections were going to occur. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're right about the guilt is a thing that runs through the book, of course, that there are many characters who think, if only I had done this, if only I had said that, or if I hadn't done this, if I hadn't said that.
Now, the police in this small town, like you say, it's set in 1972, and now when we read about a child disappearing, it's something that happens with all too much frequency, unfortunately. But set in the time frame of 1972, this was a huge incident. And the police didn't have the technology that they currently had, and you really sense the pressure on the police that they're supposed to do something. The people of this small town want them to catch whoever has taken this young girl. And you really see how difficult it was for them to function in that environment when they didn't have DNA and they didn't have the fingerprinting and that kind of thing that we have now. They're really out there on their wits trying to catch someone, and it really creates a tremendous pressure on the police force.
Absolutely, and that's I think that's testimony to how the book integrates time and place in the story that it tells. This would be a completely different book if it were set in 2005, but you're right about the police and the pressure they feel to do something to find out what's happened to Katie. And you have to keep in mind that the police chief and all of the police officers are people who grew up in this town. Everyone knows them, and it's not just that, you know, if they fail in their duties, it's not just that they fail the little girl who's missing and her family. They, in a sense, fail the entire community.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lee, the pace of this book, I started it on a Friday night, and I read it Friday, and I had some things to do on Saturday, and I was kind of cursing you as I was reading it because I couldn't put it down. And I finished it Saturday night, and you create a pace with this book which makes it very difficult to put down. And there are even points in there where you have the characters say to speak to the reader, go ahead and put this down, I dare you. And the first time I saw that, I kind of laughed to myself, and then I said, what is he doing here? But then I found myself turning the page, and I kept going. And when you were writing it, as you went through some drafts, how did you keep that pace? You had to be aware of the pace you were creating in the reader as they were reading it. And how did you do that? Did you ever try to slow it down a bit or speed it up a little bit, technically?
Well, I wanted to keep it as a representation of the way time moves during such a startling event. You know, from the moment that the family knows Katie is missing, so much happens so quickly, and so I wanted the book to capture that that speed. But at the same time, and this was my real challenge, I wanted the narrative to circle back. So at the same time we're rushing forward, we're also finding places to bring the story back and to, in a sense, start the story again. Because so much is unclear. So much is unclear about who's involved in this. And I wanted, of course, there to be that doubt about who has actually committed this crime. And the way I thought I would go about that would be to get the reader leaning one way and then turn the narrative back to a point that it would challenge what the reader had already thought. I'm thinking now of something I heard Tim O'Brien say once about how, you know, the art of the story is sort of a magic act in the sense that you think you're watching the story move in this direction when all along the writer has his hand under the table moving it in the opposite direction. And so, as I said, I'm really interested in challenging the reader. Mm-hmm. You know, you make reference to the fact that I say early in the book through Mr. D's point of view, you're going to have to listen to me to get this story, or just close the book and go back to your lives. Mm-hmm. And that may be a risky thing to do, but what I'm hoping is that I'm hooking the reader that I want for the book, which is the reader who is perfectly at ease with not knowing the truth right away, perfectly at ease with this sort of uncertainty that the book relies on.
Mm-hmm. My wife, Tina Rich, who's a very good reader, I think when we saw you at Ohio State for the Wyatt Prunty reading, mm-hmm. she said to you, we're not going to use specifics because we don't want to give anything of the plot away, but she is pretty good at figuring out who done it. And while she was reading the book, a couple times she said to me, I think this guy did it. And then 50 pages later, she said, no, I think mm-hmm. this guy did it. And I was kind of laughing to myself because by that time I knew what had happened, mm-hmm. and that's part of the fun of reading a book like this is trying to figure out who did it. And one of the things I think, Lee, that's very effective is not only do you find out as time goes on, you find out who did it, but you start to find out why they did it, which sometimes in genre fiction or in thrillers, you get so caught up in the plot that what actually happened kind of gets lost and gets kind of fleshed out a little bit. And I think that as you talk about the story coming back on itself, there is kind of an onion feel to this where you do find out more about the characters and it becomes more complicated and you start understanding some more problems that people have. And so there really isn't a point in time, I've read it twice, where the second time I read it, I still was kind of saying to myself, no, I still don't think that happened. But it seems to me this must have been a fun book to write for you.
Well,
or is that not the right word?
I don't know that fun would be the right word. One thing I learned in writing, well, first let me say that even though I want this to be a suspenseful book in the sense that I want the readers to be thinking what's going to happen next, I also want this to be a book where the why of what happened and the consequences of what happened are even more important than the plot events themselves. You know, I want this event that stands at the center of the book to ripple out through these people's lives and through this community. And then I hope by extension, through our own lives and our own present day time. You made reference earlier to the unfortunate fact that so many children are abducted these days. That's certainly true, and I keep thinking that when it happens so often, it asks us to think about what that says about us as a culture. And so I hope the book, even though it's set in 1972, has present-day relevance as well. Now I've completely forgotten.
I was talking about the fun part of it.
Oh yeah, the fun part. See how I deflected that.
Well, and I realized fun isn't the right word.
Well, yeah,
but challenging, maybe challenging.
It was very challenging, and you know, first of all, I had to inhabit some characters who are not particularly admirable. Mm-hmm. So I had to live for 3 years with some people and some events that are not particularly pleasant. The other thing I learned is in writing this book is that I'm really glad that I'm not a liar, because I learned that when you have people who are trying to keep things secret, everything they do or say opens up a whole slew of questions. And so, for example, when I was working on this book, I would work all day and then at night, my wife and I would go for a walk, and I would tell her what I'd come up with. Okay, this person's going to do this, and then this will take place, et cetera, et cetera. And she would play the role of the healthy skeptic and would start saying, well, if he does that, then won't the police do this? And why wouldn't they ask him this, et cetera, et cetera? So I would say, damn, you're right. And I would go back home and go to sleep that night, and then one or two in the morning I would wake up and I would say, oh, this is what I have to do. So in that sense, it was really hard because I'm not one who's prone to being deceptive, and I had to be as I inhabited these characters.
Is that where the dedication to Deb for asking the right questions, is that where that comes from?
That's it, exactly. It was, during the summer when we would go for those walks, she would ask all the right questions, and then I would have to go find the answers.
That's great. How did the editing process work on this? I know that Shay Earhart Books is very excited about The Bright Forever. At what point did you start getting editorial advice on this? And what do you think it was, Lee? They're obviously very excited about this book. They're behind it. At what point did they start thinking, hey, we've got a book here, I think it might be a breakout book, and we really like this, and we're going to promote it? How did that kind of happen?
I can remember last summer. No, I'm sorry. Actually, it was in September. I was in Corning, New York. I'd gone to Oswego, New York to do a reading, then I'd gone down to Cooperstown to go to the Baseball Hall of Fame, which you can't miss when you're in New York. And then we'd stop back in Corning, and I remember walking down this very charming street in Corning, New York, and my cell phone rang, and it was my editor, Sally Kim, mm-hmm. who is, without a doubt, the most courageous and gracious editor I've ever had. Sally said to me, we're starting to think that we may have something here. And I thought, well, Sally, you already had the book. Wasn't it enough? But she said, no, we're getting these quotes. We're getting these promotional quotes from Kent Hara and Antonia Nelson and Lee K. Abbott and Brett Lott and Margot Livesey, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, we're really starting to think that we've got something that might be a breakout book. So that was the moment when I believe the folks at Shay Earhart got even more excited than they had been, and things started to snowball from that point on in a good way. As far as the editorial process, Sally and I worked on this book late last summer, early fall, took it through couple more versions, mostly small things. By the time Sally got the manuscript, it was, I think, pretty much to her liking, but there are always things that can be polished and made better. And then after that, it was just a matter of seeing how people were going to respond to the book.
Good. Thank you. Let's spend a moment, if we would. You've written From Our House is a memoir that you wrote in 2000, and then you wrote another memoir, Turning Bones, in 2003. And I'd like to recommend both of these to the listeners as very good creative nonfiction books. And how did writing those two books help you prepare you for The Bright Forever, do you think? Because I love From Our House. I think it's a fabulous memoir, and it's a story of Lee's childhood growing up and his father, and something that's very well worth reading. And then Turning Bones is more of a historical look at the family. And since this takes place in a small town, it seems to me that writing those books somehow prepared you a little bit to write this book.
Well, I think writing From Our House has an influence on the writing of The Bright Forever, just from the perspective of point of view and narrative. You know, when you write memoir, you have to be skillful at using the various personae that are a part of the writer's self. So in other words, in From Our House, you know, I have to be able to occupy the point of view of the 7-year-old me, the 13-year-old me, while at the same time laying or layering in the point of view of the adult me, and God knows how many of those there are. As far as, you know, you think about how many personae we carry as adults, I couldn't even begin to number them. But, you know, Patricia Hampel said about the memoir that the really wonderful thing about it is that the writer gets to show and tell. There are those moments where you break from scene and you have this conversation with the reader and you reflect and you investigate. And all of those things are at work in the narrative style of The Bright Forever. So I see the connection in that sense, you know, from sort of a technical point of view. In The Bright Forever, as you've said, there are so many examples of characters directly addressing the reader. Well, to me, that's very similar to what the memoirs does, in the memoir. Small town life. I've lived in small towns most of my life, Columbus being the largest city that I've ever lived in. And so the places that I wrote about in From Our House and the people who occupy them are, of course, very similar to the small town of The Bright Forever and the characters there. I guess one thing about From Our House that connects with The Bright Forever is, being the story of my father, who lost both of his hands in a farming accident when I was barely a year old. In The Bright Forever, one thing I'm aware of is that whenever there is a bright light shining, and you define bright light however you wish, there's always somebody outside that circle of light. And, of course, for my father, that was painfully clear that the accident had caused him in many ways to be outside the circle of light, so to speak. So I think, you know, emotionally, that carries over into The Bright Forever.
Lee, I want to thank you very much for taking time out to speak with us today. Now, we're talking about The Bright Forever, which is available in bookstores now. Have you started thinking about where you're going to go from here, your next project? Do you want to mention that at all? Anything you're excited about, or are you in the promotion of this book, and that's pretty much taking all your time right now?
No, I'll just say that I'm working on a new novel.
Okay.
And I'll leave it at that. I think it's too early to really talk about that book. I'm in that stage where you're exploring and figuring out who your characters are, et cetera, et cetera.
Good. Well, good luck with that, and good luck with The Bright Forever. And I strongly urge everyone to go out and buy a copy of this, because it's going to be a book that you're going to read and you're going to tell your friends about. So, Lee, best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much, Casey. Really appreciate it.